It's 4:00. I have a copy of the Open Meetings Act posted on the back wall of the meeting room. Quorum call.
Pickley?
Here.
Bonnet?
Present.
Yep.
Here.
McCormick?
Here. Adoption of agenda? May I have a...
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Quorum call on that?
Roll call.
Roll call, thank you.
Pickley?
Aye.
Bonnet?
Aye.
Yep?
Yes.
Yes. I have proof of publication of the meeting notice here. Item 6, presentation of the Legal Counsel Market Analysis Report. John Winkler, Gene Tate, and I believe Ashley Tamala will be via Zoom. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Do you have them present? Okay. I'm here today with Ashley Tamala and Carolina Gallegos to present Silverstone Group's Legal Counsel Project Report. At the June 11th, 2020 Board of Directors meeting, the Board instructed General Manager Winkler to prepare a cost-benefit analysis for in-house legal counsel. To assist with this request, Silverstone Group was contacted to prepare a job description and a market analysis for in-house legal counsel to assist with the analysis. As you can see, Ashley and Carolina are joining us virtually to present their report, and they're on the screen. Before I turn the presentation over to them, there's just a couple of housekeeping issues. We're on a limited Zoom meeting link. We're anticipating the presentation to last about 10 minutes, leaving 20 to 25 minutes for directors' questions, which should be specifically related to the legal counsel project report. Once questions have been answered, we'll end the Zoom link, and directors will be encouraged for group discussion on the legal counsel project. John and I will address any additional questions you may have. So I'll now turn the presentation over to Ashley and Carolina.
Is he chatting or muted?
This one's a little bit more tricky because it's like you don't know when they're going to randomly.
I know. I think
you're on now, ladies.
There we are. Hello. Yeah, we were just saying we felt like we're waiting in the green room to be called onto the stage of a talk show. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
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 Can everybody see us and hear us and see the report okay?
Yes, we can.
Very good. Gene, are you ready for us, or are we waiting?
Yes, I'm sorry. I kind of took them through housekeeping. So, yes, you guys can start your presentation. Thank you.
Okay, very good. I didn't know if we were waiting to begin or what the, we had the green light or not. So, thank you, everybody, for having us and for allowing us to join virtually today. Caroline and I were just talking that it's certainly a different world that we're living in and a different environment from the last time that I joined one of your meetings. So thank you for allowing us to join in this format today. And just as we move through the presentation, just want to remind you and invite you to review the information in your board books if you need a better view of the information. So let us know if you have any questions or need us to stop as we're going through this. But we will walk you through the process that we took to provide the requested information when it comes to reviewing the estimated annual cost for employing an in-house legal counsel versus the average annual cost for having outside legal counsel. So with the project, we first started out by gathering the relevant background information and reviewing all of that data. So that started with data collection and review of Papio's current job description template. We wanted to make sure that we were providing an in-house legal counsel job description that's in alignment with the current format used there at Papio. We also received a list of job responsibilities and work requirements for an in-house legal counsel, so that was going to be important as we populated the job description content. We also obtained the effective date for the market analysis results, as well as the labor market scope factors of interest, similar to what we've done in the past on the market analysis project when we worked together on that. And then we also received employee benefit cost information. And then we thought it would be important to obtain a three-year historical view of the past legal fees when it comes to the outside legal counsel projects that have been completed for the district. So we wanted to make sure that we were looking at this in a comprehensive manner, as we understand that outside legal fees can vary from year to year. So we wanted to provide a three-year average to look at that from more of a consistent perspective. So once we received all of that background data, reviewed everything, got any questions answered, then we moved on to the job description development. So with that, what we did for the job description was we, again, looked at the job description template that the district uses and then filled that in with all of the information that we received from the district around what the requirements would be for this type of position if it were hired and housed within the organization rather than having outside legal counsel. So we worked through that process to get the job description developed because, as you can imagine, when we're talking about a cost analysis or cost comparison of this nature, we first have to understand hourly rates in order to start making some comparisons. And to develop the hourly rates, we needed to know what the job was that we were looking at. So first we developed the job description. And I think it's important to point out that if the district were to employ an in-house legal counsel, that individual would need to have experience and expertise in numerous areas of law that are currently being covered by the two different entities that are providing outside legal counsel today. So as you can see on the screen here, there were 12 areas of expertise identified. So again, I think that's important to keep in mind as you consider the potential trade-offs or opportunities for what this position might look like in-house versus, again, continuing with outside legal counsel. Once we finalized the job description, then we used that information to complete the market analysis. So with the market analysis, similar to the work that we've done together in the past for the compensation studies, is we looked at the job description and looked at our compensation resources to understand what is the going pay rate for a position like this. So the relevant labor market that we looked at was the Lincoln, Omaha area. We also compiled data from all industries, considering that's the type of organizations that you would be competing against or targeting your recruiting practices if you were to hire for this position. And then it's always important to look at company size factors when we're talking about compensation. So we compiled data based on $80 million annual revenue and 53 employees. So again, we gathered data from multiple survey sources to provide an accurate view of the market for this position. So you can see all of those resources listed there. And then once we obtained the market data and identified the target rate for this position, which we identified as the 50th percentile of base pay for the market, then we use that information to move forward for the cost analysis. So I think it's important to point out that the 50th percentile, it is generally considered the going market rate for a position. This is where we have targeted the compensation practices for other positions in the organization. And then also, I do think it's important, again, to just think about the extensive expertise and experience an individual would need to have to successfully fulfill this role. And so, again, targeting the 50th percentile, I believe, would be necessary to attract and retain a qualified employee for this type of position. So once we had the market analysis data and that target rate, we then use that information to develop the cost comparison, again, to understand what would it cost if the district were to hire this role in-house, and then how does that compare to the average legal fees that the organization has been seeing over the past 3 years. So, again, we're just walking through this high level, and then we can get into the detail of what those steps look like as we get to the exhibit. So, overall, with our analysis and our conclusions, we're showing that the estimated annual cost for in-house legal counsel would be right at about $292,000 to $293,000 on an annual basis. And then over the past 3 years, based on historical averages, the district has been paying an average annual cost for outside legal counsel of $350,000. So you can see that that difference is roughly $57,000 to $58,000 there when looking at if you were to take this position in-house versus continuing on with the approach of outside legal counsel. So again, the difference is roughly $58,000 more to continue with outside legal counsel. But again, I think it's important to really take into consideration, you know, if two organizations are providing these services now, you know, what's the potential for one individual to be able to have all of the areas of expertise that may be needed to move forward with one person doing the work in-house? One other thing that I think is important to point out here, big picture, before we dive into some of the detail and your questions, is that when we reviewed the cost comparisons, all of our numbers are based on employee-only coverage. When looking at the district's cost for insurance, we felt that it was we would be making too many assumptions if we were trying to, you know, make assumptions about the person's marital status or if they had a family or not who needed coverage. So all of our numbers are based on employee-only coverage. So I think that's important to point out as well. So that's a high-level overview of the process that we took to provide the requested information on the cost comparison, and then all of the details are contained in the exhibits. And again, this information is in your board book. Should you need to reference any of the details or the small print, I can't tell for sure how large this is on your screen there, but this is the overall job description that was developed. So again, this person would be responsible for all legal matters for Papio. And then education and experience requirements. We'd be looking for a JD in this position and a minimum of 10 years of experience. So those are just a couple of factors that I wanted to point out on the job description. We have the market analysis results and how to interpret all of that data. So this should be pretty familiar to a lot of you who've been involved in those board conversations and discussions in the past where we've talked about the employee compensation studies and market analysis results. So again, a very comprehensive review of the market for this position, looking at positions that are good comparables, and again, in that relevant labor market of interest. So this is where we gathered the data for the $245,000 base pay target rate. Those are the survey sources we utilized. We utilized data that comes from HR professionals only. It's data that we pay for, so we definitely focus on quality when it comes to providing data. And these resources are updated regularly. You can see that they are updated, a lot of them on a monthly or quarterly basis. So again, very current, comprehensive information for the market analysis. Those are all the survey job summaries that we matched this position to in those resources. And then we get into the cost comparison for how we use that information. Again, looking at employee-only coverage, we pulled over the base pay 50th percentile for that row of information. We looked at all of the group insurance coverage that the district is paying for and provided all of the calculations on benefits. And then that brings us to the total that you see down here. And for the average annual cost for outside legal counsel, again, we wanted to look at an average year rather than just providing a snapshot of 1 year because you can see that the legal fees have varied over the past few years. So we looked at fiscal year 2018, 19, and 20 numbers, as well as what's been budgeted for legal fees for 2021 to come up with those overall numbers that you see in the cost analysis or the cost comparison. And then there is one additional page of information to share. So again, our data, we're looking at employee-only coverage. Do I have my last page here?
We're still seeing our page, Ashley.
Yeah, that's all I'm seeing here, too. Caroline, I don't know if you're able to pull that up. For some reason, my attachment isn't showing here. I can talk you through it, though, and that should be in the board book, correct, Jean?
It is.
So on the additional page that you have in your board book, the district did prepare an extra worksheet, you know, anticipating what questions you might have. And so wanted to provide additional information on what it looks like when we are comparing benefits for family coverage. And so if we're looking at family coverage compared to employee-only coverage, that does add an approximately $11,500 of additional cost for the district when it comes to the insurance coverage. So I wanted to make note of that as well, as that, you know, again, we can't make a lot of assumptions about what the, you know, a potential new hire might require for insurance coverage, but did want to provide you with that additional information as well. So I apologize, that's not pulling up on my screen. I don't know. But you do have it there readily available in your board book. So that, again, you know, provides you with an overview of the process we use to provide the requested data. What questions can we answer for you about the process or the findings?
Director Japp?
I had a question regarding the attorney. Does he require, or do you figure in an administrative assistant of some sort, or is he using in-staff secretaries, or does he take care of his own secretarial work, or how does that figure in also?
Based on this analysis, that individual would be responsible for all of that work. It wasn't calculated into the analysis, any type of administrative assistant salary or, you know, portion of that type of individual's expenses. Jean, I don't know if you have any additional insight that you want to share on that component.
I don't. I was going to say we would have to use whatever existing staff we have here and make changes to job descriptions, and if the need existed, we'd probably have to look at hiring another person to come in and support that position.
Great, thank you.
Director Bradley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question. One, the average annual cost for outside legal counsel, you tabulated, and it might have been averaged over the last 3 years, if I heard correctly, $350,408. Of that outside legal counsel, it's two firms, Hush Blackwell and Baird Holmes. And I'm wondering if you have the breakdown averaged over the 3 years, how much was Hush Blackwell and how much was Baird Holmes?
It's in there, Larry.
Yeah, right on the screen here, you can see a majority of the fees are coming from Hush there. Blackwell.
It's $329,100 for Hush, it's $21,308 from Baird Holmes.
Thank you. And then do we know what, of the 12 areas of law, what of that 12 does Hush Blackwell cover, and what 12 does the Baird Holmes cover?
The only thing Baird Holmes does for affirmative action
and bonding,
the rest of the 12, including the 12, would be Hush Blackwell.
And those are listed on page 4. Of the report, Director Bradley.
Oh. I have one more question.
One more question. Do we know how many approximate hours per week we utilize outside attorneys at this time?
Well, we get a report from Fresh Block every month with their billing. I don't know if you know what
I'm saying. Well, assuming the in-house attorney is at a 40-hour-a-week job or so forth, and I'm
yeah, well, it'd be salary, so if he would, you know, be on 24, I mean, he could. I'm sure.
Or she.
House counsel would be 24/7. He would not have a 40-hour work
okay.
week. He would have more of a 70-hour work week. So.
All right.
Or 60, yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. They're calculating just under 2,100 hours, which would be 40 yeah, hours right. a week, plus okay. a little.
Plus yeah. more.
Director Bagley, question?
A couple questions. Looking over that the cost comparison, am I reading this correct that you're basing this on that the NRD would pay 100% of the medical and all the benefits are paid 100% by the NRD?
For the employee, for employee health and vision.
Okay.
And dental.
For family, it's 66%. Yeah.
Yeah,
the district pays 66%.
Okay, so I was reading this wrong, that it's not 100% that the district's paying?
No,
okay.
Not on family.
Okay, but on the individual one, it was. So if we hire Jane Smith or Joe Smith, that we'll pay 100% based on the market analysis. Is that right?
Other benefits.
Yeah.
Other benefits.
Health and dental.
Right, and that was listed on that one page, not the one that she was missing, but
right.
that is 100% paying the individuals. All those benefits are paid by the NRD.
Right.
Is that? Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Okay, so is that? I'm just curious. What do they compare that with? That would say we would pay 100% of that. That's pretty rich benefits.
That is taken off from the NARD risk pool billing that we get every month.
There's other people that are paid those benefits.
Employees receive 100%. Of their medical and their vision and their dental paid for. If it's employee spouse or employee child or family benefits, the employee is responsible to pay 33% okay. of those benefits.
A couple other questions if I can.
Mm-hmm.
Where did they measure those, the percentile of the benefits, what were those measured against? That I'll have to go back, but the...
So the market analysis, we're basing the base pay rate off of the 50th percentile in the market, and then we use that to calculate the monthly premiums and the calculations that you see on this page that's still showing here.
And one other kind of leads to a follow-up. So you're saying that just based on your analysis that the pay rate would be 50%. If let's say you put it at 30%, that would knock it down. Would you say that there'd be a less pool of men or women that would apply for this that are equally qualified if it wasn't based on 50%?
I think the district's ability to attract high quality candidates would be hindered by a lower target rate, yes.
That's interesting. Okay, thanks.
All right.
Just so one other fact, the three-year average of costs, I can't let this go without saying a significant portion, percentage-wise, maybe small, but those legal expenses to a former director that we would not ordinarily have expenses for. So that three-year average is inflated a little bit because of behavior problems. So hope that we won't incur that in the future.
All right. Ashley, if I could ask one question, and maybe you can't answer this, but what are the chances of finding someone with expertise in all these areas?
Yeah,
very often attorneys are very specialized. So.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I do think that's one of the big picture questions that we have for the board and the district is, you know, what is the ability to find one individual with all of those areas of expertise? And not only that, but the capacity to do all of this work as one person. And I think, you know, that is, it's a valid concern, a valid question, because right now if we're looking at the amount of work that's being done by two organizations and the need to pull in two organizations and their teams to provide the services and the expertise that's needed, I think that right there points to the answer that it would be rather difficult to find one individual who can cover all of these areas and have the time and capacity to do it well.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Discussion? Dr. Burnett?
What action has the board taken to renegotiate our existing contracts with the two outside firms?
John, you want to take that one?
Yes, so we brought a contract to the board. Huck-Blackwell's contract expired at the end of June of this 2020. And we brought a contract to the board for approval to extend it by 3 years. And then that was ultimately the board voted to extend it a year. And then part of that motion was for us to do this analysis of in-house versus outside counsel. So that's how we got to this point in time. So their contract will expire in June of 2021 if no action is taken, either to renew it or another step. So that's why we're here.
So, John, is it fair to say that we've got this data now that maybe you'll come back to us with a recommendation over the next couple of months?
So I think this is a recommendation, so no action's taken, obviously. And I've got a couple more things to add to this. But so I think there should be some discussion, at least in my opinion, and what I would like to see is some discussion Thursday of what direction the board would like me to take. Would you like to enter into a negotiation or solicit a proposal from current legal counsel to continue that, whatever term that may be, or is there an interest to open up, RFPs and have firms come in and interview? So that's something that I think hopefully I get some direction from the board, and whatever you choose, we will obviously do it. So I hope on Thursday that you as a group can give me that direction to do. And, okay. And like I said, we'll do either one. Just a couple other of notes. So working with other NRDs in the state, when we talked, I talked to all the general managers and DNITs, and no other district in the state has in-house legal counsel. And one of the issues is that the level of detail and expertise that it takes in all the different projects and programs we do, there is very few, if any, there may be a handful of people in the country that could probably do all 12. And there's no one locally as far as anyone that I talked to knew. I also reached out to Tim Burke because OPPD did a similar analysis in their organization. And right now, Fraser Stryker is their outside counsel, and it's a firm. And he indicated they did a white paper. He couldn't share it with me because it was confidential, but he basically said that they calculated that they would spend 20 to 25% more on in-house counsel versus going to outside counsel to have, a firm of 150 attorneys or whatever that firm had to be that they could draw on. So those, I just wanted to reach out to my peers and to other organizations to see where they stand. So as Tim said, he indicated they would have to go out to other firms or to hire more than one attorney to handle all their business. So.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Director Davidson?
Yeah, you answered mine. I was going to ask if any other NRDs around the area use, outside.
Yeah, no one. Everybody contracts with an attorney or a firm or whatever.
And I guess my concern would be, we kind of go through this with the city of Bellevue sometimes, what happens when the attorney goes on vacation? Who do you get to cover for that? I'm assuming they've got at least 80 hours of vacation, maybe more. Do we have a backup plan for that, or how do you – stuff doesn't stop when they go on vacation. So,
right.
What's the plan for that?
Right. And so for some of the new directors, we had a situation where it was an outside counsel, but it was a one-man show, and work suffered, especially toward the end when we really started to do a lot of different projects. Literally every day staff would approach me saying, hey, has
has legal counsel reviewed this? Has legal counsel done? And our work was getting pushed back, and the efficiency of the operation was really it was detrimental to the organization. And so when that person retired, it was an opportunity to really, you know, to go with an outside firm. And I have not heard one comment, and Marlon can verify this, that we're ever behind on a issue that we send to legal counsel. I mean, it gets done, both Baird Home and Hush. So,
okay, one more question, Director Bradley.
But just maybe a follow up on General Manager Winkler. When we got the agenda for Thursday, I didn't see anywhere on there where there was an item to vote or give you any direction of where we wanted to move on this. So I didn't know if it was too soon. That's according to the chair or vice chair to make that decision. Maybe if we go on with that Thursday or that kind of thing.
Agenda.
Oh, it is?
It is on the agenda for the report.
Right. It's not an action item.
It's not an action item. The resolution will simply say, the report was presented, no action was taken by the subcommittee.
Right, and
but
so
it will be on the agenda.
Right, and that was our direction, is to present this report. We're presenting this report, you know, I would say that we should make a as a collective body. You should make a decision on this pretty soon, because if in fact the direction is that we have to go to an RFP process, that takes a little time, and I don't want to be put in a position where we're scrambling in June if we did not renew with our current council to find somebody to do this when we have so many projects going on and a lot of different acquisitions, and we're finishing up the Missouri River. I mean, we just have so much activity. I would not want to put ourselves in a position where we do not have representation. It's just bad operation. I would not recommend that for this body.
John, when I joined the board, we had one attorney.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing everything.
Mm-hmm.
When did we hire on Baird Home to do two things?
Gene, do you have that? I don't. They were here when I was here, so I don't know.
Okay, so Baird Home prior to Hush Blackwell, used to handle all of our employee issues, our district policy manuals, and our affirmative action. Now the only thing that Baird Home is doing for the district is they process the affirmative action policy, and they do the employee Harrison rates to make sure everyone falls in within an area of promotion that they needed to for their pay, and then the bond council information that they review, that they work with DA Davidson on. That's the only thing that Baird Home does for us now.
But before 2009, Fred, they did. We didn't have bonding authority, so we had no one to review bond because we didn't have the ability to issue them.
Okay.
So that's when Baird Home picked that up.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Davidson, one more question. Maybe Ashley, this might be for you. I'm looking through this job description, and it's pretty impressive. And then I look through the summary here, and you have the. Am I right to read that you expect? I know it's professional services, so it would be negotiated, but you expect to pay $245,000 a year. And then the benefits on top of that, is that kind of what you're basing that on?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Through the market analysis, yes, that's the base pay target is right in the middle of the market at $245,000, and then the benefits would be an additional $47,000 for employee-only coverage for that total of $292,000.
And just to be clear, that includes no support staff. That's just one person to do all.
Correct.
12 items. Okay, thank you.
We're running out of time for Ashley, so I wanted to thank both you and Carolina for being here and for the hard work that you put in to do this report.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us again. Thank you for allowing us to join virtually. It was very helpful. So thank you. Good luck with the rest of your meeting, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Any other discussion, John?
I just would fill with that. So if you look on that other sheet, there lists the other expenses, and that's where, you know, so you go into litigation liability. So we'll have to get a special liability writer for if you have an attorney. And then you have to, you know, there's bar dues.
Sure. I guess my concern, John, was
periodicals. So they have to be, you know, you have to buy software for them to be able to access case law, things like that. So it's just not an attorney. It's all the supporting pieces with him.
And I guess my concern is I haven't been here long enough to know 100% of this and what everybody makes. But if you're going to pay somebody $200,000, you know, I'm assuming that's going to bump up some other salaries. within the organization as well, I would think. You know, once that seems, I mean, that seems pretty high for one.
Yeah,
that's what I. That's another thing to think about too.
For that, yeah.
So, what would your grade be?
A bazillion.
It'd be way over that, wouldn't it?
Any other discussion? Okay, with that, we are adjourned.
Well, does anyone need to go to the bathroom or before we start the next committee meeting? If not, programs, projects, and operations subcommittee meeting, February 9, 2021. Before we start, Director Fowler will not be here. Director Teaser will not be here. Director Burnett, you are part of the committee. Okay. Item number two, notification of open meetings law, posted on the back wall on the door. Quorum call.
Burnett.
Here.
Yeah.
Here.
Sabinski.
Here.
And Jefferson.
Here. Item number four, adoption of agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Motion, motion and second. Roll call.
Jeff.
Yes.
Sabinski.
Yes.
Burnett.
Yes.
And Jefferson.
Aye. Item number five, proof of publication of meeting notice. We have proof of publication of tonight's meeting, which will become part of the permanent record. Item number six, review and recommendation on resolution to adopt the district's multi-hazard mitigation plan. Lori Lassiter.
Bill, do you have her? Okay. Okay, Lori, if you can hear us, you are all good to go.
Okay. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
So, first up tonight, I have the district's hazard mitigation plan. This plan is what allows us and the entities within the district to be eligible to access FEMA mitigation grants. The district first adopted a plan in 2006, and we are required to update that plan every 5 years. So the last time we updated it was in 2016, and we have just gone through and drafted our next update, which is due in June. And so Becky Appleford with JEO, who is our consultant on this project, is kind of going to go through the plan and what we did, and then tonight we are asking you to formally adopt the plan before we send it on to FEMA and NEMA for review.
Thank you, Lori. Just give me a moment here while I get the PowerPoint here going and shared. And while I'm getting this set up, I just want to express my appreciation for being able to join this meeting virtually. As I'll explain here in just a moment, we had to pivot rather quickly to a virtual setting last year for COVID-19 precautions. So, again, appreciate you continuing to offer this as an option during the pandemic. So my name is Becky Appleford. I'm the project manager for the Papua Missouri River NRD Multi-Hazard Mitigation Plan update. It was a pleasure working with Lori and the NRD 5 years ago for that final update, and again this time as well. It's just been, personal note, I love working with Lori and the Papua NRD. It's just been a really great experience, so thank you very much. So project schedule, I know that's kind of hard to see here, but on the far left side of the schedule is January of 2020. That is when the project officially kicked off, and we met with the regional planning team, which consisted of county emergency managers across the six-county area, along with highway superintendents, floodplain administrators, some city officials, as well, and along with some stakeholders such as the National Weather Service joined in on that meeting. So we discussed project and plan goals and objectives, what types of hazards we wanted to include in this plan update, and any other concerns or questions regarding the planning process at that point, and any special jurisdictions that we wanted to ensure to include in the plan update as well. So that was 1 year ago, and we scheduled all of our meetings. The scope of the project included 6 round 1 and 6 round 2 meetings, one meeting being held in each county throughout the planning process. So we had scheduled out those in-person 6 county meetings for April and May of 2020. And leading up to the first round of meetings, we were also scheduled to have an in-person open house to officially kick off that public engagement portion, which was going to be held in Omaha. However, 2 weeks prior to that open house occurring, COVID-19 really impacted our area, and we started to see those public health measures being instituted. And while we did try to reschedule that, obviously here we are, we ultimately decided to cancel that, and I'll explain what we did in exchange for that in just a moment. So those round one meetings, we did shift those to virtual through utilizing Zoom meeting format. We had 5 virtual public meetings instead of the 6. The 6th one was Burke County. That was the very first public meeting we were scheduled to have, and due to time constraints, we ultimately decided to have that as a one-on-one. We did offer the one-on-one meeting option for all participants, for those that were unable to join the public meetings, whether it was due to scheduling conflicts or just were more comfortable meeting either by phone to go over the information we needed to collect. CRS, which is a community rating system, was also a good significant portion of this project, where we worked closely with the City of Omaha, Papillion, and Valley. It's the same planning process, however, it's just diving in even more deep to the risks and ultimately the mitigation strategy to reduce the risk to flooding. So we held one-on-one meetings with those communities as well, and they had a very robust local planning team. So those meetings officially kicked off in June. Then we get through the summer here, and that's where working with Lori and Jen there at the NRD, we came up with the idea of, well, we can't meet in person, let's then ultimately shift the open house type information to an online format to engage the public in a social media campaign. And I'll provide the details on that in just a moment, but that really was August. That was a 4-week, 5-week public engagement social media campaign. Round two meetings were held in October. We had 6 virtual. That time we did have 1 per county, 6 virtual public meetings and 11 one-on-one meetings. And we completed the draft plan by early winter of 2020 into 2021. And the plan went out for public review throughout January and ultimately concluded the public review period last Friday on February 5th. So we are looking to incorporate the final comments that we've just received into the plan, finalize the document, and submit that to FEMA and NEMA here in just a couple of weeks. What were the hazard mitigation plan goals as identified by the regional planning team? Well, ultimately, it's the 4 that you see here. These were the plan goals that were identified included in the 2016 plan as well. So there were no significant changes to the overall goals. We did make some minor tweaks to the objectives, but as you can see here, really good overall plan goals, which were to protect the health and safety of the public, reduce or prevent future damage to critical facilities, critical infrastructure, and maintain their operation after a hazard, reduce or prevent future damage to existing properties and natural resources, and lastly, to promote multi-agency coordination and resources. Diving into the community participation, so this planning process was open to all communities across the 6-county area, focusing within the district, the Papio NRD district. However, as you can see here, the western portion of the 2 counties, Thurston and Burke County, were included as part of this plan. In 2016, we officially had 37 participating jurisdictions in that plan. For this plan update, we have 42. So despite COVID-19 and having to shift to online engagement, we still had really robust engagement and participation, which I'm really happy about. We did see some new participants in this plan update. That includes the Village of Hubbard, Winnebago Indian Tribe, Washington County Fair Board, West Community Schools, Emerson Hubbard Community Schools, Gretna Public Schools, and Ralston Public Schools. So we did have a couple of schools ultimately decide to not engage in this planning process for this plan update that did participate in 2016. And that's primarily because of COVID-19. We're seeing this across the state in many of our plans that the schools that have participated in the past just ultimately do not have the resources or capacity at this point to engage in this planning process. So we will certainly reach out to them in the future to get them back into the plan. That's always available to them in the future. But as you can see here, we did still have some good engagement with the public schools. Three communities continue to opt out of this planning process, which were the villages of Boystown, Kennard, and Washington. They did not participate in 2016 and, again, just opted to not be included in this plan. Hazards that were addressed in the plan. We have 14 of them, and they run the spectrum of natural hazards, which is really the ultimate theme of focus of these plans. However, we don't live in a world where we do live in a world where chemicals exist and other man-made hazards do exist. But those are addressed as well. So we cover agricultural, animal, and plant disease, chemical and radiological spills due to fixed locations like chemical plants, chemical transportation, dam failure, drought and extreme heat, earthquakes, flooding, grass and wildfire, high winds and tornadoes, levee failure, public health emergencies. So that one was added because of the pandemic. While it wasn't identified at that initial cleanup meeting, the planning team, when we did get together during the summer, we agreed that public health needed to be addressed in the plan, so that was added. Severe thunderstorms, severe winter storms, and terrorism. So by identifying these hazards by the regional planning team, this really provided a focus for the local communities and jurisdictions to review this list and prioritize which hazards were of greatest concern for their communities and their local jurisdictions. Because while one community may have a high hazard dam near their community that could potentially impact them if there were any issues, another one does not have any dams nearby, so it does not have to address dam failure in their plan. So it really makes this a plan specific by community. Okay, so some other neat assets of this project included the project website. This was a new addition to this planning process that Lori thought would be a really good addition and ultimately was serendipitous because of COVID-19. This is really the first of its kind in the state of Nebraska where you have a project-specific website that's going to be available and maintained and updated outside of the five-year update. So while we developed this website during this planning process and utilized it throughout the engagement and outreach during this planning process, now we will be able to hand it over to the NRD and for Lori and those at the NRD to utilize it, provide new information, use it for outreach and so forth in between the plan updates. So I'm really excited about that. And if you haven't been to papillomitigation.org, I do encourage you to do that. There's a lot of great information on there, some really neat project highlights that you can see here on the left-hand side, highlighting the dry flood proofing at Blair Water and Wastewater Treatment Plants, among others. So as I said, this was utilized throughout the planning process. It was critical when we decided to do the social media campaign. and also for the public review comment period, so people could submit comments through the website and get those to us directly. The current 2016 plan is available there, along with, because we just finished the public review period, the current draft of the 2021 plan is available for viewing and download. You can submit comments, and I believe that will be available throughout the lifespan of this website, really. As I've already noted, project highlights are there and can be added and will be maintained by the NRD. And then lastly, the Would You Rather social media campaign. So as you recall, this took the replaced the open house that was supposed to happen in March of 2020. So we took the available funds for that and pivoted to this online Facebook, Twitter, and even the Nextdoor app engagement to gather information, get people talking about hazards, how they impact them or don't impact them, in a really fun and engaging way. We partnered with MediaSpark to come up with the idea and ultimately partner with some key influencers on Facebook to get the word out about this campaign and how people can get talking about drought and tornadoes and blizzards and flooding. And it drove people to the PapioMitigation.org website, which is fantastic, and ultimately to fill out a survey so that we could gather that information and analyze it and get it into the plan. So, again, this is the first in the state of Nebraska that we've done this type of social media campaign outreach for hazard mitigation planning. So that's really exciting. The goals of the campaign were to increase awareness of the hazard mitigation planning process. It's kind of a obtuse type idea of what is mitigation planning. So we ultimately wanted to educate people about what that is, what is a hazard. Improve community commentary. Again, get people talking about it. What are their local concerns regarding these hazards? And then ultimately obtain that feedback via an online survey or inclusion in the plan. So the survey results was astounding. We had over 650 surveys that were submitted that were from the local NRD area. So we had them provide their zip code, no personal information other than their zip code, and an email was provided. And so we had a lot of great local information from residents across the NRD. They provided information through various questions on what hazards impact them or have impacted them in the past, they've ranked them. So what do they feel is the most concerning or impactful hazard? They identified mitigation projects or what they felt the plan should be focusing on or as a region we should be focusing on or even locally should be focusing on. And then also they provided some information on how they're personally taking ownership of mitigation in their home, how they are prepared for disasters, where a safe place is to go, if they have text alerts and so forth. So some of the suggested mitigation projects ultimately, which was good to see, aligned with ones that were already identified by the local planning teams, but it just really solidified that we were on the same page as a community. So some of those suggested projects were alert sirens, educational outreach, emergency exercises, improving community coordination and communication, flood reduction projects, building storm shelters and identifying them, improving the snow removal resources, and removal of dead or dying trees. So that's just a handful of some of the suggested mitigation projects.
I think we should.
So with that, the next steps are finalizing the document as we speak, getting it ready to submit to NEMA and FEMA for the review and ultimately approval. We are looking to, once we get that approval from FEMA later this spring, that's when the jurisdictions, all of the 42 jurisdictions in the plan, will want to adopt the plan. So we will have 1 year from that notice of approval to get all of the communities to adopt the plan. And then ultimately, we want to see communities implementing these projects and taking action that they've identified in the plan and putting it to work in their communities. So with that, I just want to say I appreciate your time here today. If you have any questions or comments, I welcome them at this time.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Is Lori coming back on the screen?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. We can have a motion on this item before we have any discussion. Anyone wants to make a motion?
We have so moved.
Motion against second?
I'll second it.
Okay. We can now open it to discussion. Ted approved it. Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors? Director Burnett?
Lori, of the municipalities that participated in this study so far, are they uniformly using the hazard alert siren system uniformly?
I don't know that I would be able to answer that. It's slightly out of the scope of mitigation planning. Becky, do you know?
I do not. That would be really at the county emergency management level. Are you referring to like warning siren alerts, the audio ones?
Yes.
For tornadoes? What I can say is that all of the communities do have some sort of alert system, such as a tornado siren. It is varying on ownership and maintenance of those sirens. I know in Douglas and Sarpy counties, those are owned and maintained by the county and are set off by emergency management, whereas in some of the other communities, those are locally owned by either the community or the fire district and are set off either by the fire department and again, sometimes it with coordination with the emergency management. But that is a pretty consistent mitigation project that is in place, and we do have several communities that have identified mitigation projects to either improve or replace aging tornado sirens.
Any other questions? Roll call.
Spinski?
Yes.
Bonnet?
Yes.
Jack?
Yes.
And Chairperson?
Aye. Thank you very much for your presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Lori.
Oh, I've got the next item too.
Oh, you got the next one too? Go right ahead.
I do. Okay. So for the next item, we have the a contract amendment with Fire Engineering for Phase 3 of the Southern Sarpy Watershed Partnership Watershed Management Plan. That's a mouthful. And in 2016, we formed the partnership to address the expansion of sanitary sewer service in Southern Sarpy County to make sure that new development is managed appropriately for water quality and water quantity goals. After the partnership was formed, we hired Fire Engineering to begin developing that watershed plan. We have recently completed phase 2, and so this contract that we have before you tonight is for phase 3. And I think that FIRA has a presentation that they were going to give.
Mike?
Yeah, I'm here, Lori.
Okay.
So Lori and Marlon asked me just give you a quick update, keep it to 5 minutes. So in my normal fashion, I'll try to fit in 374 slides in 5 minutes by speaking very quickly. So a lot of information here. I'm going to go over the big picture stuff just to kind of update everybody. Always happy to meet and discuss some of the details of the plan. Generated a lot of information, made a lot of maps, so there's a lot there. So this was the original plan development schedule. So you'll see it was originally planned to have 3 phases. In general, phase 1 was kind of a development of baseline conditions. What's the current status of the county? in terms of really focusing on four technical factors: hydrology, hydraulics, stream stability, and water quality, and aesthetics kind of wrapped in together. So that's what we're kind of focusing in down there, and those four technical parameters. Phase two is for the alternative, the development of alternatives and assessment of alternatives to say, what are the tools in our toolbox we can help prevent the effects of development and continued degradation just due to aging in the watershed. So that was the end of phase two, and then phase three is to actually wrap that up, form an actual plan to follow, discuss some other details like financing and how to implement this. And that's one of the things that the counties have really been, all the partners have really been focusing on, is how do they make it so that it's the same for each one of their communities, so that each different planning jurisdiction or whatever can move through, take these plans, read it very easily, and then kind of move on. And we're doing the best we can to take some subjectivity out of some of what they do as part of their plan. So we're on schedule, on budget, starting phase three here. As you can see, we'd hoped to finish up originally in 2021, and I'll show you a schedule at the very end of this. So really in, as far as the development, we focus on, in this part of it, we focus really on two big ones. Number one is peak flow management, and the other one was stream stability in the watershed. So with that, the policy, general policy for peak flow management was they wanted to do what we can to look at all the alternatives so that we don't have increases along the main channels through there due to development. So there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, what does development do to the hydrology, et cetera. We've got a lot more rooftops, et cetera. What can we do to counteract that and the negative effects that happen on the stream and the stormwater system that are usually associated with that sort of development? So as you see, and I think I showed you all once before, except for some of maybe the new directors here, the red stars you can kind of see on that map are kind of what we call comparison nodes. So we set up a series of comparison nodes in a watershed. We basically looked at, using the quantitative tools that we have, we looked at those comparison nodes and said, what's going to happen here with and without developments, and what's development going to do to this area? What can we do to protect that there? So we've assessed the flows through peak flow management as looking at that. So some of the alternatives that were considered here, I won't go through these in detail. Regional detention, which you all know very well, obviously a big tool that was used in the Papio watershed. On-site detention is kind of a developer detention, you know, storm bases, et cetera, they put on site to help counteract some of those. But then a big one that we looked at, because of this watershed, because of the shape of the watershed, the steepness of the watershed, relatively steeper valley sections that we have here in Papillion Creek watershed, we did look at another facility that we're going to talk about called linear corridor storage facilities. So all of those are tools kind of in our toolbox to help us counteract those effects of detention as we move through there. So what we did in each one of these watersheds, and this is just showing the Springfield Creek watershed, there's Springfield Creek and then Zweibel and Buffalo Creek are the three main watersheds that we worked on, and there's also some other unincorporated areas that aren't part of those. But we basically looked at each one of those comparison nodes and said, okay, what's the changes here? So on the right side of your screen, probably hard to read, but in essence, pre- and post-development there, we're talking about increases somewhere between 15 and 20% of flows. And that's just peak flows, doesn't include the increase in volume that goes along with those. So in each one of those watersheds, we said this is what we're trying to match pre-development. So we came up with a series of feasible project locations. On the left, for instance, we looked at regional detentions. That is where, when we look at roads and homes and utilities, all the development, and we're, you know, we originally started this plan thinking we were going to be ahead of development. I'm not sure we won that race. With everything going down there with solar power, the development of the wastewater system, Platteview Road, huge data centers, obviously, they started getting it ahead of us on some of these projects. We started figuring out we're losing some ground that are potentially available to some of these sites. So what we did was went through and looked at regional detention sites in the watershed. All those on the left were potential sites that could have been could have helped us. And on the right there also looked at what we called linear corridor storage, which is kind of a new facility here to us that we're going to talk about here a little bit. And then we looked at what does it take to combine them there. So this is kind of a typical rendering of what a linear corridor storage facility would look like, where we basically create an impoundment. And what you see there is kind of an exaggerated Z scale there that kind of shows we build almost a little levee next to the creek. Force water into that through a weir on the upstream side and then drain it off. So it works almost exactly like regional detention, but smaller, less invasive, less costly, et cetera. So this was a facility that we're looking at that came up with some different sizes here. We also stay under dam safety criteria with these, et cetera.
So in looking at these, we went through and came up with this decision matrix that I won't bore you with here, but basically what we said was we're going to do the best we can to mitigate peak flow increases on the main channel using linear corridor storage facilities first, and then we'll supplement that with regional detention when we need to. And that came out to be most technically feasible and most cost feasible on that. So this is what the decision table would look like here, where when we look at one particular, this is all just attributable to one particular node that's in the bottom left here, and it kind of showed how we built on alternatives as we go from left to right in the chart, which I can show you the detail on sometimes if you want it, but we just got to what do we need to do to mitigate the peak increases along the main channel at that particular node. And we went through there and came up with a plan there. So once that was completed, we've now got areas in the watershed where we're starting to stabilize the channels too. So the next thing we're working at is stream stability. So we got into the details on this alternative. We kind of stopped for a while because of the study you did in Papillion Creek Watershed Partnership Project, but B, also because the Corps of Engineers was doing a degradation study for you that we'll talk about in just a second. So we kind of got into this, the details of this, stopped, did all the peak flow management work, and now we're just coming back to this. And so we had made some real good progress at the end of phase two, and this is what we're going to be working on. Basically, what can we do down there to help protect these soils that are down in southern Sark County are a lot more erodible than they are in Papillion Creek. And so what do we do to counteract the negative effects of those? And how does that affect the policies that you come up with? So we've also went out and, as part of phase one, did an inventory and said, where do we have, and this is kind of a typical traffic light, green, yellow, and red, where do we have streams that are in great condition right now that we want to protect? And therefore, where some of the other ones that aren't as in good a shape, maybe those are the areas we kind of focus projects on because we already need to help remedy another problem that already exists there. So once we're done with all of that, we'll be able to put it all together there. So as part of that, I kind of mentioned this. On the left there, you see on the top, you see a couple images that were just presented to the Papillion Creek Watershed Partnership and talked about stream setback policy. That's been a big item of discussion in southern Sark County. One of the things we know that we want to do is try to make those policies the same in both so we're not to confuse developers. So we worked together on that, and I think finally came to an agreement with everybody on the direction we're going to take on that. And then, as I mentioned at the bottom here, the Corps of Engineers finished up a degradation study. We'll also use the results of that study as we continue to finish up this part and then finish up the plan that goes along with it. Once we're done with the peak flow mitigation work is done, once this is all wrapped up here, we come to a decision on the policies here, then really what's left is to write the plan and figure out how to implement it. More coordination we've been doing is HDR is working with the Southern Sarpy Sewer Wastewater Agency. So I think, as you know, they're designing a series of trunk lines to figure out how do we service sanitary sewer in Southern Sarpy County. They looked at everything from building one or two treatment plants down there in a couple locations to now what they're actually going to do is build trunk lines and actually pump it over the ridge into Papillion Creek, and then Omaha's going to expand their plant there to handle that. So this corridor is very important in terms of stream stability. We're looking at where it crosses streams, et cetera, and we're coordinating with them right now on how this will help meet some of our goals, and they're working hard to work within the direction of the watershed partnership as well. So next steps here, I believe you have a contract in front of you. These are some of the tasks that are there. Be happy to answer any questions, but they kind of show generally what I just talked about in terms of what we need to do to finish up phase three. And then lastly, there's our schedule. And so as you can see, everything goes well this year. We've basically got this work coming over the period of about 12 months, starting tonight, hopefully. And it will be finished up right about the end of calendar year 22 or 21, just at the start of 22. So that's the task and also the schedule that's associated with the proposed amendment tonight. That's all I have. I took more than my 5 minutes.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Mike. Lori, is Lori coming back to the screen? Thanks a lot for the presentation, Lori. Thanks, Mike. We can have a motion on this item.
Motion to accept staff recommendation.
Motion. Have a second.
I'll second.
Motion and a second. Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors?
I have one question.
Director Japp?
The cost, our cost of this is being shared by all the other partner entities? So what's our...
It comes out of the partnership budget.
Okay.
Any other question?
Mike, you mentioned the data centers, just massive amounts of concrete roofs. They have to retain their stormwater, correct? Or a big portion of it?
They do. They've been, you know, we're looking at some of the policies about how much you have to detain. The interim policy has been used as a 100-year storm, so they're actually providing a 100-year detention on site for their particular, which is no small task for something that big.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're providing a lot of detention on site.
Okay, thank you.
Any other director questions? Roll call.
Yes.
Jeff?
Yes.
Sivinsky?
Yes.
And
Hi. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you.
Item number nine, review and recommendation, number eight, review and recommendation on modifications on district policy 17.37, small flood control and water quality structure program, Terry Schumacher.
Good afternoon. We're here to discuss the review and recommendation on modifications to district policy 17.37, small flood control water quality structure program. The policy 17.37 was adopted by the board in February of 2000. It was titled the Small Flood Control Structures. Since that time, which was 21 years ago, one structure has been constructed under that program. So the thought process was, given the fact that we have a goal of two wet detention basins in our 319 watershed program that was approved, and we have a program on the books in the policy manual, how could we retool, modify that to make it more effective to help reach the goals of the watershed plan? And so if you looked at the red line version of the policy, there's some suggested changes. Probably the biggest one is the fact that on these projects, the district would pay 100% of engineering and construction costs, where before, under this program, it was a 75-25 split. I guess, in my opinion, this puts this program in line with what we've done in the Silver Creek watershed, which is a special watershed, and the Pigeon Jones watershed, which was a 319 watershed. As you know, we have PJ-12A under construction currently, that we've worked with landowners up there, and so this would really be a similar program to what we've done in those two watersheds. And there's potential for 319 funds to help with any engineering and construction costs as we move forward. With that, I'll entertain any questions.
Thank you very much. We can have a motion on this item.
Should accept staff recommendations,
A motion. Can we have a second?
I'll second that.
Second. Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors? Director Bennett?
With the lowering from 500 to 300 acres, how many new projects do you foresee coming up? Are there any projects that you've already identified that meet that criteria?
Not specifically. I mean, through the years, we've had people talk to us about some, potential projects, but nothing that's, that's kind of the minimum size projects that we've done in the other watersheds. It was at 500 for this program, but we just suggested 300.
Any other questions from directors? Director.
Terry, we're just basically making this a lot easier to get these projects done, or possibly more of them.
In my opinion, that would be correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Jet?
I want to clarify that the landowners are actually donating their land to have these built, correct?
Under this proposal, they would be paid 50% of appraised value.
Okay, 50%.
Yes.
And these are permanent water retention facilities?
Yeah, and they would be billed as high-hazard flood control structures. We would operate and maintain those.
Okay.
Any other questions? Roll call.
Jeff?
Yes.
Kaczynski?
Yes.
Bonnet?
Yes.
Ann Jefferson?
Hi. Thanks, Terry. Thanks a lot. Item number 9. Review and recommendation on agreement with OPVD for transmission line reroute at WP1. Amanda. Grant?
Good evening.
Good evening.
Bill, could we go to the map somewhere buried in that? There were a couple maps. This is the next map, if you can. There should be one more after that. So this is WP1, flood control detention basin, that we're discussing tonight. So this is a proposed reservoir located about 180th and Fort Street. And let's check if it's on. And here's 180th Street, and Fort Street sits up here off the page. So this is one of the priority reservoirs that we've been working on for quite a while. We've purchased some land just recently. We got another big parcel of land. And also to note, this particular structure has NRCS federal dollars to construct it, and it also has Water Sustainability Fund money to construct it. So excited to start this project very soon. Like to start it, maybe a tad optimistic, but like to start still this year in 2021 with construction. So in order to do that and stay on that construction schedule, we have always known that there was an OPPD transmission line that crossed the site right here. And sadly, it's in a private or their own easement, and so the district is responsible to pay for the relocation of that to get that around the dam and the spillway. So this, where the transmission line sits right now, it would have to span. Well, it can't span the spillway, and it's of course at the widest part, really, of the reservoir, so the spans don't work. So we've been coordinating with OPPD since the beginning, throughout the preliminary design, and it's now time for us to execute an agreement with them to relocate that transmission line. They're going to come around. You can see their new alignment come around here and then tie back into the existing line as it cuts through Indian Point. So they've provided us an agreement to do that work with an estimate. So this would be a not to exceed estimate for the work. It's a pretty detailed estimate though, for $788,701.21. It's so expensive to relocate these big transmission lines. But we had estimated from the May 2018, I know that was a while ago, but we had Olson is the engineer for this site, and they had presented the preliminary design and the estimated cost for this, and they thought $750,000. So we're pretty well in line with what we thought it would cost. So we're recommending that we are able to execute the agreement with Omaha Public Power District to relocate that portion of the transmission line for just over $788,000. They can only do their work at a certain time frame, so we want them to get started and get done and be out of the way before we come in with the construction of the dam embankment and the spillway. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer those.
Thank you very much. You can have a motion on this item.
I move to go staff recommendation.
I'll second that.
Second. Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors? Director Thompson?
Yeah, if we can bury cable across the ocean, why don't we go underneath and bury in the water?
Danny's fault.
Yeah. I mean, if anyone from OPD is... Oh, I did. But, I don't know. I haven't thought about that until I looked at this map. Wonder, have we ever run lines under the water itself?
Maybe Director Begley can say it might cost more than $788,000.
It'd be a hell of a bore shot, wouldn't it? Going under the water.
We don't have salt water to contend with. We don't have.
I do not know. Therefore, I cannot say.
the issue has always been with the utilities, especially that they might come even though like underground is subject to, is less subject to storms and things like that. It's always maintenance. they always want to have them available to maintain them. And if they're buried underneath a lake or underground, it's more difficult if there's an issue with them.
So they need a paradigm shift, is what you're saying.
That's not even OPPD, that's NPPD, that's any utility. No. They want them available to maintain and replace them.
Higher cost, too.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know that.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I was wondering on this basin, how many acres big is it? Will there be any fish in there at all?
Yep. So this, we actually just had a call. I just had a call last week with Game and Parks. This is going to be another of the reservoirs that we work very closely with them. They'll contribute some dollars. They have some dollars available. They're working on another grant to get us more. And, in fact, in this particular one, this is going to be a trout lake for them. They're going to use this to have some trout, which we don't have very many of those locations. But I think they might take them out of Standing Bear when they – and then they can – they just live one season, as I understand. So, do some different things with Game and Parks here. And this is a little bit smaller. It's probably 25-acre lake. It's a smaller one.
Sir, are you finished?
Yes, sir.
Okay, any other questions from directors? Director Bennett?
Why is it that we would bear 100% of the cost of that?
Because it is in an easement that it's in an exclusive easement of theirs right now. So the way I understand that, and we did have this at Prairie Queen, they had just located along the road right away. So when the road was vacated, it was their cost to move the power line. When they're in an exclusive easement and it needs to be changed, it's the person asking for the change that pays for that.
Who'd they get the easement from?
Probably the landowners back when they put the transmission line in.
And that easement is permanent?
It is. And we will also, after the relocation, need to give them an easement.
Okay. Any other questions? Roll call.
Spinsky?
Yes.
Bonnet?
Yes.
Jack?
Yes.
Aye. Thanks, Amanda. Item number 10, review and recommendation on Big Papio Levee Culverts Project Phase 2, Amendment Number 2 to Professional Services Agreement with Fire Engineering, Martin Cleveland and Linda Rogers, Fire Engineer.
Good evening. Linda Rogers is with me. She's with Fire Engineering, been serving as a project engineer for this project. These maps that are on the board show the locations of these 16 culverts that are located in Douglas and Sarpa County. And back in September 2017, district approved a contract with Fire Engineering to have them design, permit, bid, and then also help with the construction of these 16 culverts. At the time we did this, we didn't know how many things you can run into when you do a repair of a 40-year-old structure, but there's a lot of things that happen. And so there was initially, and this last fall, there was amendment number one, which was to allow for a scope change because there was a lot of additional things needed at 13 of these 16 culverts, such as deterioration of the site after the flood of 2019. In addition, some of these culverts have just basically fell apart more since they were initially televised by us probably in 2015 or so. So things have changed quickly in 5 years even. So now tonight we're actually talking about amendment number two, which is to basically to deal with one twin structure down in Sarpy County. It's south of Cornsker Road. It's called BPL 15A and B. And it's located underneath the City of Omaha sewer, which basically conveys about one-third of the sewage in Omaha down to the Papio treatment plant. So it's a major, major structure, and it's in not very good shape. As a side note, when they started doing work in this structure, they realized, unfortunately, right away, that the structure wasn't where the plan said it was. And so that meant we had to go back and do some additional surveying, some additional excavation work, coordination with the City of Omaha, some changes in design to accommodate this fact the sewer wasn't where the as-built sewer plan said it was. It was built in the 1970s, And this, again, the sewer is in very fragile condition, so we had to be very careful about what we do to not damage it because we're, again, underneath this structure. We couldn't get too close with the excavation. So all these things basically added up to additional work that Fiber had to do to make this thing actually work so we could build it properly. The structure is in place now, and we're basically the project is essentially next spring we'll wrap it up. There's just miscellaneous things that have to be done yet, but unfortunately there's some additional work that was incurred by Fiber to do this, to finish up this work on 15A and B down south of Cornersky Road. So we're asking tonight to approve amendment number 2 to the agreement with Fiber to add additional $19,554.75 for a total not to exceed of $414,332.75. I love those cents. Subject to changes deemed necessary by the general manager and approval performed by district legal counsel. Lindy and I would be happy to answer any questions you have about this amendment and why we're here tonight.
Thanks a lot, Martin. We can have a motion on this item.
I'll move that. I'll motion for that as written.
Okay. Have a second?
Second.
Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors? Director David?
Do you have any, are we planning on closing that trail anymore, or has the work pretty much been done? This is just kind of finishing up the paperwork kind of thing.
So the trail's completely back in place.
Yeah.
There was a tarp that was put over the concrete for cold weather protection during their initial pour. Unfortunately, that has frozen into the ground since then, so they can't get that tarp out of place, but the contractor's monitoring it and making sure that they've placed rocks and additional material on top of that tarp so it doesn't blow over the trail. But the trail's completely open.
I haven't got any questions about it this week, but when but when the weather is nice, we do get a number of questions about
and
that.
And they do still have to backfill. So they got the trail in, like, right at the nick of the snow.
Yep.
So they still have to backfill the shoulders as well. So it's probably good that there's something on the side that they're kind of a little bit leery about so they don't go off the side. But there will be it's finished for trail closures.
I appreciate the information you give me as I ask these questions.
Linda, could you identify yourself for the record?
Sorry.
You identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Lindy Rogers with Fiber Engineering.
Okay, thank you. Director Thompson.
Refresh my memory. When we awarded this design or to your firm, you all going to use a camera to go into the culverts and all that? Is this the same project?
It's not the same project.
Okay,
no.
Then.
That's for the Little Papio culvert rehabilitations.
Okay, never mind.
So,
never.
Yes.
This was televised by the PAPNRD staff, basically, and then we gave those videos to Fiber to use. But like I said, unfortunately, things changed in 5 years, and there was like a rusted car. Things seemed to fall off of it after a while. So,
any other questions from Director? Director Jett?
I had a question, just a general question. Is there any negotiation ever involved whenever we get additional billing, whether it's this or anybody else, or we just say, yeah, okay, we'll pay it? We always come up with additional amendments and additional costs and so forth, but does our staff review this carefully and negotiate this? Or
typically, it's typically like this is like out of scope work, so these were unforeseen issues that occurred,
uh-huh.
Or additional work, or there may have been delays by weather. So we sit down with the vendor, the fire or whatever, professional services or whatever contractor that may be, and the staff verifies that all these things are accurate. And then again, then we discuss price. And so, yeah, it's consistently, we verify that everything is exactly what they say it is and why we need the additional work. And then also, our staff has a rough idea. When you got Marlon's been here for over 40-some years, and obviously Martin, they have a very good handle on how much these additional services should cost. And that rate's probably already in the initial contract that we did with them. So the amendment would be simply to add more time to those tasks. So, yeah, that's pretty well vetted before it gets to you.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions? Roll call.
Bonnet?
Yes.
Jack?
Yes.
Smitsky?
Yes.
And
Anderson?
Aye. That completes the PPO.
Thank you.
We can take It looks like anybody want to need a break? We can take 5 minutes. Anybody need a break? Well, we already lost one director, so.
Rock and roll.
But he's not on the board, if you guys are okay. Not hearing no dissension. We'll carry on through this committee meeting. This meeting is called to order for the Finance Expenditure and Legal Subcommittee. A copy of the Open Meetings Act, Nebraska REV State Statute 84.1407 through 84.1414 is posted on the back wall of the meeting room. Prior to turning to the agenda for today's meeting, I would like to announce the procedure that will be used for this meeting. With respect to each agenda item, the directors will first hear staff proposals and recommendations. Then the public will be given the opportunity to speak to the item. Lastly, the directors will discuss the item and take action, and we will ask that the public not interrupt the director's discussion and action. Thank you. Quorum call.
Henley?
Here.
Conley?
Here.
Davidson?
Here.
Chairperson Bradley?
Here. Adoption of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Roll call.
Aye.
Conley?
Aye.
Davidson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Bradley?
Yes. And proof of the publication of meeting notice has been posted. And we move to item number 6, review and recommendation for extension of contract for auditing services. Carrie Fry and Jean Geraltz, if I pronounced that correctly, forgive me, that they can announce themselves at the podium. Bergen KDV. Go ahead, Carrie.
Good evening. Under policy 15.2.B.3, we are required to obtain proposals for auditing services every 5 years. A recent 5-year contract with Bergen KDV was completed with the fiscal year 20 audit. However, due to the impending upgrade and transition to new accounting software, it would be better to retain our current audit firm until we are well established in the new system. In case we have any issues or complications, it would be better for the auditor to be familiar with the district and its programs and our accounts. So we would request that the board waive procurement policy and allow us to extend the engagement for 2 more years. Bergen KDV has submitted a proposed contract for fiscal year 21 of $48,000 and $49,000 for fiscal year 22, which is in line with previous years. And Jean Garlitz is also here to answer any questions you might have about the proposal or the firm.
Motion to approve.
Do I have a second? Seeing that, then anybody from the public wish to speak on this item? Seeing none. Directors? Director Bagley?
So it's an extension of 2 years to the 5 years that they've been here now?
And then 2 years from now, we would go out for RFPs.
Is there a reason why we wouldn't just do it for a year?
Just to be on the safe side, I guess, as a contingency. I mean, we can do whatever you want.
Yeah, the glitches. What are the glitches?
Well, hopefully not.
Maybe I don't want to know. I don't know.
We won't know until we're in there.
Well, and so if there is glitch, and so if you have a new firm, you know, then you're then there's going to be just a huge re-education curve, and then if you have to do entry, you have to do re-entries and all those types of things. It would definitely be more effective and efficient to have a firm that knows exactly what they've done or what we do and what we've done over the years, so it will take a lot of stress and discomfort off of our books and know that they've got that back in case they need it.
Okay.
And for a new firm, too, I think there would be some stress and discomfort to a
new
firm.
For both, right. It would cause, just some unnecessary
okay. Thanks.
Issues.
Any more questions? Director Thompson?
I think our new accounting software is going to take a couple I don't want to say how much time you can tell us that, but wouldn't that be part of the equation that as our staff, as we get comfortable with that new software, and the guys doing our audit would also parallel that? Maybe one more period beyond 1 year would probably be sufficient.
I think it generally takes a couple cycles to work all the kinks out of anything.
Yeah.
Well, and then when we go out, and two is when we go out for bid. Another issue is when we go out for bid and we're very familiar with the software, then that's calculated in any proposal. So what software system do you use? So it kind of feeds back how much work the auditor will have to do on what kind of data you use to buy what kind of software you have. So that may lower the price or somehow affect the rate sometime in the future. Well, until we know that system, we really don't know what the issues are or how good it is or not.
Any more questions? Director Bonnet?
I'd be behind on this, but what were the deficiencies of our prior system that necessitated a change?
They're discontinuing support for the payroll module at June 30th of this year. Unfortunately, we had to upgrade now. I would have rather waited a couple years, but we didn't have a choice.
And you're going with which title?
BS&A. It's specifically for local governments. Gretna and La Vista use it. We went through several and settled on that as the best choice for us.
And just as a follow-on, this firm is not familiar with that software yet. Are there other firms that we're aware of that are and have been using that software title?
Well, I think that Berg and KDV does have some clients that use this particular software. I couldn't speak to any others. Do you have anything to add to that, Dean?
Yeah, I'll mention.
Please state your name and who you're with, please.
Thank you. Gene Garls, partner with Berg and KDV. Yes, we do audits of other governmental entities that use this software, so we are familiar with it as we are with a number of software packages.
All right, any more questions? Vote on the agenda item on the motion.
Aye.
Davidson?
Yes.
Edley? Aye. Jefferson?
Yes. All right. Motion passes. Item number 7, review recommendation of land acquisition of West Papillion Regional Basin 2, WP2. Amanda, do we need to go into executive session?
Yeah, I recommend we go into executive session.
Okay.
Motion going to executive session.
Do you have a second? All right. Roll call on that.
Yes.
Beckley? Aye.
Conley?
Aye.
Jefferson?
Yes. We're going in executive couple of minutes while they secure the room. Motion by Director Conley, second by Director Begley to come out of executive session.
Begley?
Aye.
Conley?
Aye.
Davidson?
Yes.
Jefferson?
Yes. All right. All right.
We need a motion to approve. Motion to approve.
Moved by Director Conley. Do I have
I'll
a second?
Second it.
Second. Second by Director Davidson. Any discussion? Seeing none?
Conley?
Aye.
Davidson?
Yes.
Bagley?
Aye.
Jefferson?
Yes. That, we are adjourned.